South Dakota Public Broadcasting, sdpb.org.
We'll call this meeting of House Judiciary to order and ask our secretary to please take the roll.
Representative Engel.
Here.
Representative Feinstein.
Here.
Representative Gibson.
Present.
Representative Gosch.
Here.
Representative Hamill.
Here.
Representative Hoffman.
He's excused.
Representative Killer.
Here.
Representative Lust.
Here.
Representative Moser.
Here.
Representative Schleckaway.
Here.
Representative Turbeville.
Here.
Representative Hunt.
Here.
Representative Cutler.
Here.
12 of 13 are present, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. We do have a quorum present. Well, this morning we want to first welcome our pages who are helping us today. That is Miranda from Aberdeen and Desiree from Huron. Thank you for helping us out today. Just a reminder that cell phones should be off or on vibrate, and we'd ask anyone testifying on a bill to remember to please sign in, and if our interns could please make sure that all witnesses are accounted for by signature. Thank you for that. A couple of housekeeping things this morning. We will have a bit of a change in the calendar. We'll take up House Bill 1079 first. I think it's listed last on your calendar. And the chair will defer House Bill 1086 and 1089 to Friday. So with those changes noted, we are ready to begin our business today. So welcome once again to House Judiciary, and welcome to our internet listeners. The chair entertains the approval of the minutes.
So moved
by Turbeville, seconded by Ingalls. Any discussion? Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Are there any opposed? Our minutes are approved. Thank you. So we move in our calendar to House Bill 1079. We are open for proponent testimony on House Bill 1079, an act to revise certain provisions regarding the sex offender registry. Good morning, Mr. Swear.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Scott Swear at the Attorney General's Office, appearing on behalf of Attorney General Long for House Bill 1079. And we'll see if this works today. There we go. All right. House Bill 1079 is an act to revise certain provisions of South Dakota's sex offender registry. And what 1079 does is it makes two important revisions to our sex offender registry. The first revision is that it closes the sex offender registration loophole, which we will talk about here in a few minutes. The second important provision is it provides equal protection for juvenile sex offenders. So those are the two main objectives of House Bill 1079. A little bit of history real quickly of the sex offender registry. Like all states, South Dakota has a sex offender registration and notification system. We are mandated by federal law, as are all the other states, to have that registry. Our registry was passed during the 1994 legislative session, and the registry's fundamental purpose is this. It's the tracking and notification of the public of sex offenders' whereabouts. Pretty simple. It's the notification and the tracking of sex offenders for the protection of the public. In South Dakota right now, as of this morning, we have 2,506 registered sex offenders on our registry. Our sex offender registry statutes are found at Chapter 22-24B. And for those of you who are interested, I have the actual sex offender registry site provided to you both in your bill brief and in the PowerPoint presentation. Let's talk about the first revision to HB 1079. It's again closing the sex offender registration loophole. The current law in South Dakota is this. It's that a sex offender has to register within 5 days of one of these five criteria. Number one, 5 days of residing in South Dakota. Number two, register within 5 days of temporarily domiciling in South Dakota. Number three, sex offender has to register within 5 days of attending school in South Dakota. Number four, attending post-secondary classes in South Dakota. And finally, number five, working in South Dakota. Again, if a sex offender does one of those five affirmative acts in South Dakota, he or she has to register within 5 days. Here is one of the issues with the laws that's written now. These five affirmative acts, residency, domicile, attending school, post-secondary classes, and working, they've created a loophole in our sex offender registry statutes. The loophole was brought to us by law enforcement. Law enforcement has found that primarily out-of-state sex offenders are momentarily entering South Dakota, primarily because they're looking for a driver's license, they're coming to register for their motor vehicle because of our cheap fees, they're coming into South Dakota to get a postal address, and also they're coming into South Dakota to register to vote. In the bill brief that I gave you two examples. One example was Jim Johnson, and the other example was Jane Smith. And those two examples give you some practical, really meat on the skeleton as to how these loopholes are being used by out-of-state sex offenders. Again, because in those examples, Jim and Jane don't meet the five affirmative acts that we have in place right now, they can come in and do those four things: driver's license, registration, postal address, and voter registration. They don't have to register. What 1079 seeks to do is we seek to revise the sex offender registry statutes to include these additional four affirmative acts. By accepting these revisions, 1079 does this. Number one, it prohibits people like Jim and Joan, or Jim and Jane, from dodging the sex offender registry law. It prohibits them from simply coming into South Dakota, registering their motor vehicle, and then wandering around the country. Wandering around the country, of course, unregistered and unchecked, which is against the fundamental purpose of our registry of notification. And finally, HB 1079 protects the public from sex offenders, again, by closing this loophole. The second revision that 1079 accomplishes is it provides equal protection to juveniles. Right now, under South Dakota law, any adult, anyone 18 years of age or older, who is convicted of what's termed a sex crime, and for adults, there are approximately 20 crimes that constitute a sex crime. Just a couple quick examples: rape, sexual contact, criminal pedophilia. Those are three sex crimes that would subject someone to the register. And again, there are approximately 20. Plus, any attempt to commit one of those 20 crimes also constitutes a sex crime. So we have between 35 and 40 different crimes that subject an adult to the registry. One exception to the registry is if a defendant receives what is termed a suspended imposition of sentence. For those of you who aren't attorneys, a suspended imposition of sentence occurs when a court can place a defendant on probation upon certain terms and conditions. If that defendant satisfies the judge's terms and conditions, that person can then have their conviction, so to speak, discharged. And it's just like the person never had any type of criminal conviction. A person is eligible to receive one of those suspended imposition of sentence during their lifetime. It's discretionary with the court. Judge doesn't have to give it, but if the judge deems that it's appropriate, the judge can grant a suspended imposition of sentence. Here's why that's important for 1079. If an adult receives a suspended imposition of sentence on one of those sex crimes, he can automatically be removed from the registry if indeed he's successful in getting his suspended imposition. So he is automatically, he or she, the sex offender, is automatically removed from the registry if he successfully receives a suspended imposition of sentence. Here now is where the issue comes in. In 1997, this legislature required juveniles. Now, just juveniles who are 15, 16, and 17 to register. We aren't registering 10-year-olds. We're not registering 12-year-olds or 13-year-olds. The juvenile registration provisions only apply if you're 15, 16, or 17. You have to be as a juvenile adjudicated guilty or adjudicated of a sex crime. The difference is, as I stated earlier, for an adult, there are approximately 20 sex crimes that get you on the registry. As a juvenile, there are only 3 crimes that subject you to the registry. And those 3 crimes are rape, felony sexual contact, and promotion of prostitution of a minor. Those are the 3 crimes that subject a juvenile to the registry. The issue came up, however, that in the current statute, there is no provision for a juvenile to receive a suspended imposition of sentence. And of course, in juvenile court, there's no such thing as a suspended imposition of sentence. It applies to an adult, but not to a juvenile. So what happens then is on a sex crime by a juvenile, the juvenile has to remain on the registry for life. They don't have any opportunity to get off the registry as would an adult. What happened is that provision was recently challenged. It's a South Dakota Supreme Court case, the people of the state of South Dakota in the interests of ZB. Real quickly, here's the story in that case. We had a 15-year-old who admitted to committing 2 first-degree rapes. He admitted to it in juvenile court. ZB was then ordered to register as a sex offender. And of course, as I stated before, the statute did not provide ZB as a juvenile with any type of suspended imposition of sentence opportunity. Meaning, of course, because ZB was 15, because he committed a rape, technically, he is going to be on the sex offender registry for the rest of his life, not until he just reaches 18 or 21. The South Dakota Supreme Court in November of 2008, just a couple months ago, found that because a juvenile was not given equal protection of the law, because a juvenile is not allowed to get off the registry under the suspended imposition of sentence exception like an adult has, that our sex offender registry as it applies to juveniles violates ZB's equal protection rights under both the federal and our South Dakota Constitution. What the second part of HB 1079 does is that it addresses the South Dakota Supreme Court's decision in ZB, and it gives juveniles the same rights as an adult has to be removed from the registry. If a juvenile under this bill receives what's called a suspended adjudication of delinquency, all right, that is the juvenile court equivalent of a suspended imposition of sentence. All right, so if the juvenile receives a suspended adjudication of delinquency from the judge, the juvenile now is given the opportunity, just like an adult, to get off the sex offender registry upon completing the judge's conditions. So what 1079 does is it balances the juvenile's rights with the fundamental purpose of protecting the public. So that's really what 1079 does. Again, the 2 important objectives are, number 1, it closes the sex offender registration loophole that we talked about. And number 2, the modifications provide equal protection for juvenile sex offenders, thereby, we think, complying with the South Dakota Supreme Court's recent decision in the ZB case. There is one more thing I need you to take a look at. You have been provided an amendment for House Bill 1079. And what this is, it's a real short little amendment that on page 2, line 4 of the bill, after the term resides, we're now inserting applies for or receives a South Dakota driver's license, registers a motor vehicle, establishes a postal address, registers to vote. What it simply does is it makes both of the provisions in HB 1079 consistent. So it's simply really a style and form amendment. The Attorney General would ask you to favorably consider House Bill 1079 and the amendment that we've provided. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there further proponent testimony for House Bill 1079? Mr. Thiessen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dick Thiessen. I'm an attorney here in Pierre, and today I speak to you on behalf of the South Dakota Sheriff's Association and the South Dakota Chiefs of Police. This summer, I think it was, a case came to my attention, which I'm circulating, in which a defendant, a convicted sex offender from Colorado by the name of Rice, found his way to South Dakota, where he registered, or came to South Dakota, registered his vehicles, applied for a South Dakota driver's license, and did so with a motorhome. South Dakota has become, in our view and in our concern, a place for sex offenders to hide. Mr. Rice had been a registered sex offender in Colorado since about 2004, and in July, as you see from the opinion, he kind of fell off the map and no longer was registered in Colorado. The court opinion suggests he deregistered. I don't know how you do that, but in any event, he was no longer registered in Colorado, nor did he register in South Dakota. He was then arrested by the Hanson County Sheriff's Department because he had failed to follow the law and register as a sex offender. In the opinion that I have circulated, you find that Judge O'Brien, one of the former members of the House, had ruled that he did not feel he could find him to have violated that statute beyond a reasonable doubt, which of course is the standard that has to be applied there. And that was because there were questions about whether applying for a driver's license, registering a motor vehicle, were sufficient to constitute residing in that county, Hanson County. So the bill before you attempts to correct that problem. The sheriffs brought this to my attention. They were very concerned, and I think rightfully so. We know there are three different companies in South Dakota that have become very attractive to people, whereby they can register their vehicles here and take advantage of the inexpensive fee for registering their vehicles. We did not think of this, obviously, when we passed the sex offender registration law some time ago. And now that it has come to our attention that it is being misused by those who would like to hide and likely continue to be offenders. Otherwise, I don't know any reason for them to want to hide. We think that it needs to be addressed this year and that we need to close that loophole so that South Dakota does not become the hiding place for those who are registered sex offenders elsewhere. And because they did not fit the full definition of being a resident here, would now be able to hide. The amendment clearly says that if that person comes here and they seek or obtain if they apply for or receive that driver's license, or if they seek to register their motor vehicle, or if they establish a postal address or register to vote, that any one of those things will trigger their requirement that they register with either their chief of police or their sheriff so that we know where they are. I'd be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Is there further proponent testimony for House Bill 1079? Seeing none, is there any opponent testimony to House Bill 1079? If not, we will close to proponent and opponent testimony and open to questions of the committee. Representative Ingalls. Any questions of the committee? Representative Lust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Mr. Swear. Mr. Swear, do you have any information regarding how many crimes have been committed by previous sex offenders who were not on, not registered with the state of South Dakota? The state of South Dakota?
Madam Chair, I do not have those numbers, Representative Lust. That's something that we could certainly, through our database, DCI, attempt to track down for you, but I don't know the recidivism numbers right off the top of my head on that.
Follow up,
Representative Lust.
Are you aware of any?
I know personally of at least a couple cases that I just know of that have come through the office. Again, I don't know what the exact number would be, and that's just my personal knowledge of seeing a couple things come across my desk.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Other questions of the committee? Representative Turbeville.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. One question, if I may, Mr. Swear. You indicated we had 2,506 people on the sexual offender registry. How would one of them, what do they have to do or how long to be on there? How do they get their name off there?
For an adult, of course, one way to get off the registry is to receive a suspended imposition of sentence. That's the first way. The second way, there are provisions in the statutory scheme that after a 10-year period of being on the registry, a person can actually apply to the court if they meet three or four different criteria. The court then makes a decision as to whether or not that person should or should not be off the registry. But the initial trigger for that is, of course, they can only do that after they've been on the registry for 10 years. So that's one way a person can get off. Again, the other way is the suspended imposition of sentence. Now, what happened when the recent Supreme Court case came down is we had 47 juveniles on our registry. Those juveniles then were taken off of the registry because the court found it was unconstitutional. So that's just a couple quick numbers on the juvenile numbers. But for an adult, those are the ways you'd get off. A juvenile also could, after 10 years of being on the registry, make a motion to the court, again, if they meet certain criteria, to be removed. And the court would then again determine whether or not the juvenile should be off the registry or not.
Further questions of the committee?
Madam Chair.
Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Swear, could you get me the citation for that 10-year removal reference that you just had? It doesn't have to be now, but if you can get it to me subsequently. Second, at the bottom of page 1, line 13, we say that the term adjudicated includes a finding of delinquency and then an admission and a suspended imp, etc. What's the sense in which an admission is being used here? If you could comment, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Swear.
Thank you. Representative Hunt, as you know, when we're dealing with the juvenile court system, it's obviously a different system than the adult court system. So in juvenile court, we don't use terms like someone pleads guilty or not guilty or things like that. In juvenile court, we use different terms of art. So instead of someone being found guilty as they would adult court, a juvenile is found to be delinquent. Instead of a plea of guilty or no contest that you'd have in adult court, in juvenile court, if a juvenile pleads what we know is guilty, that's actually called an admission. It's not a plea of guilty. So that is why we have the term an admission in there. That is the juvenile court equivalent of a guilty plea.
Thank you. Thank you,
ma'am. Other questions of the committee? Representative Mosher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have a sense or even, I guess, preferably hard data to show how often or what the frequency is of minors receiving a suspended adjudication of delinquency in sexual assault cases, and for that matter, adults receiving suspended impositions in sexual assault cases.
Mr. Sawyer.
Representative Mosier, I do not have those numbers. What I can tell you is that whether or not an adult receives a suspended imposition of sentence or a juvenile receives a suspended adjudication of delinquency obviously turns on the judge that he or she is in front of. Some judges in certain counties are more apt to give suspended impositions or suspended adjudications than others. Perhaps, and I'm just using this as an example, Judge Glenning in Yankton may give more suspended imps or suspended adjudications than would Judge Jeanine Kern in Rapid City. So it really just depends on the court you're in and the judge that you were before as to whether you will receive those or not. If you would like, we could certainly work with the Unified Judicial System to get those specific numbers. It would take a little bit of work, but those numbers are in the computer database that either UJS or our office would have.
Can I just have a quick follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Mosier.
I would appreciate that, and I don't need a breakdown by county. Statewide data would be sufficient. Thank you.
Other questions of the committee? Representative Gosch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Swear, I am also curious to see what the conditions are under that statute for getting people off the registry. I had a voter contact me and tell me that he had made a mistake in his early 20s, and now 25 years later, he's losing jobs. People are seeing his picture on the registry. He's turned his life around. It's adversely affecting him in many ways in the community. And I guess if you could get that statute to all of us, or if you know what those conditions are you referenced in there, if you could speak to those.
Mr. Sawyer.
I would be happy to get you the statute. There are certain sections and subsections in the statute that the person has to meet, so I can't tell you exactly what every section and subsection are, but I'll be happy to get that cite to you immediately after the hearing today.
Thank you. Representative Ingalls.
I could save you a little bit of time, Mr. Sawyer. The statutes for a petition to remove your name from the sex offender registry are 22-24B-17 through 20.
What is it?
22-24B, statute 17 through 20.
Thank you. Other questions of the committee? If not, we'll close to committee questions and open to committee discussion or action on House Bill 1079. Representative Gosch.
Madam Chair, thank you. I would move the amendment 1079-RA.
Is there a second? Moved by Gosch, seconded by Ingalls. Remarks, Representative Gosch.
Just quickly, I think this makes sense. It not only fills the loophole, but fills it completely by adding this to another section of this statute. Thank you.
Is there further discussion on the Gosch motion to amend? That would be 1079-RA as distributed to you. If not, this is a voice vote. Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Are there any opposed? House Bill 1079 is so amended. Anything further of the committee? House Bill 1079 as amended. Who is that? Sorry, Representative Lust.
I move do pass as amended.
Move do pass as amended by Lust, seconded by Hunt. Remarks, Representative Lust. Is there any further discussion on House Bill 1079? If not, we'll proceed to vote on the do pass as amended for House Bill 1079. The Secretary will please call the roll. Those in favor will say aye. Those opposed, no.
Representative Ingalls.
Aye.
Feinstein?
Aye.
Gibson?
Aye.
Gosch?
Aye.
Hamel?
Aye.
Killer?
Aye.
Lust?
Aye.
Moser?
Aye.
Schleckaway?
Aye.
Turbeville?
Aye.
Hunt?
Aye.
Cutler?
Aye.
Madam Chair, 12 ayes. One excused.
And House Bill 1079 goes to the floor. Do pass as amended. Representative Gosch, would you please carry that bill to the caucus and on the floor for us? And Representative Gibson, would you please explain it to your caucus? Thank you very much. Committee, we've finished our first bill for this morning. Let's move on in the calendar then to our next bill. House Bill 1084 is an act to permit the appointment of a special advocate to represent the best interests of an parent or alleged abused or neglected child. And with that, we're open to proponent testimony on House Bill 1084, and welcome Ms. Roberts.
Thank you. How a Chief Justice bill is comes about and ends up before you. The legislative process for the UJS, the Unified Judicial System, which is the judicial branch of government, begins as soon as this legislative session ends. That all the judges of the state, magistrate and circuit judges, are encouraged to suggest ideas if they have observed anything in the past year in the process that needs to be changed, adjusted, or improved. Those ideas are forwarded by a certain date in early summer to my office for research and drafting, and then they go to what we call the Fall Judicial Conference, where all the judges attend for training and for consideration of any proposed legislation. At that time, it is debated, amended, and then voted on. A bill or a proposed piece of legislation gets the title of a Chief Justice bill if it receives a majority of the vote during that Fall Judicial Conference. So I just wanted to give the newcomers a little update of where this comes from and what the process is on that. With that, Madam Chair, thank you for your indulgence. I would testify on 1084, which is before you at the request of the Chief Justice. This is a very good bill. And it's a very simple bill, and I won't take much of your time. At the present time, the current law says that a special advocate for a child, we call them guardian ad litem or special advocate, you might have heard the term CASA, court-appointed special advocate. They are appointed to children, whether they're CHINS, which is child in need of supervision, a delinquent, or an ANN, or in various juvenile proceedings. What our judges would like to do is, and there was some debate whether or not they could appoint a special advocate for the child before adjudication. It's provided for in current law upon adjudication. But when there is an involvement by DSS, or there might be some involvement by the police authorities or whatnot, we use the terms apparent or alleged abused and neglect child. So we, the judges, are wanting the opportunity to appoint a special advocate to be there for the child as soon as the child gets in the system when it is an alleged or an apparent ANN. And that is simply what this bill does. It's permissive. Special advocates are free to the state and to the counties. They're volunteers. And it is to assist the child's attorney if needed, and also to always represent the best interests of the child. With that, Madam Chair, I'll stand by for questions if anyone has any.
Thank you. Is there further proponent testimony for House Bill 1084?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Susan Randall, representing South Dakota Voices for Children. We would urge your support of House Bill 1084. Adjudication of a child for abuse and neglect can take a long time. Last year, you amended the statute and said that the judge may place the child in temporary custody out of the home for a period of time, because they are an apparent abused or neglected child. And so there might not be any adjudication that would even happen in that case. But the child could certainly, in many cases, benefit by having an advocate appointed, and so we would urge you to support this legislation. We think it's a positive measure.
Thank you. Further proponent testimony for House Bill 1084. Seeing none, is there any opponent testimony to House Bill 1084? Seeing none, we'll close to proponent and opponent testimony and open to questions of the committee. Are there any questions of the committee? Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could ask Ms. Roberts, just a quick question. Do we have defined in statute the term special advocate?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Roberts.
Representative, yes, there are statutes that deal with that, and I have them. If you start looking in 16.2.50, that's the definition, and CASA, K-A-S-A, is defined as court-appointed special advocate. And then if you refer to 16.2.51, it discusses court-appointed special advocate's program, and it specifies that it is recognized by the National CASA Association Incorporated, and they have guidelines, and we also have guidelines of who can be a volunteer with CASA, and also funds and have been set up for this program also, if you look at 16252.
Follow up,
Representative Hunt.
Anytime you mention funds or money during this session, you're going to get a follow-up question. You just mentioned fund, and earlier in your testimony, you said this was all volunteer. Now, what are the funds that we're talking about here?
If you look at 16252, and that has been since 2003, there's been established within the state treasury, a court-appointed special advocates fund to be administered. And those funds come in has been provided through contributions, grants, settlement funds, and payments ordered by the court, and interest receives on the money in that fund. And then for fees and monies collected, and then there's other statutes that show where those are coming from. It's nothing new. And that those funds are used for the purpose of funding and administering the grant program. So I am not involved in any of that distribution or anything that. There's a statewide CASA program. But my point is when the court appoints a CASA or a special advocate, those people are volunteers through that program. It's not the same as a court-appointed attorney or, for the child, which the counties are responsible for. It is someone that is trained. They go through training. They have to apply. They're screened. They're fingerprinted. They go through background checks. And they have to be sworn in by the judge. But then there are people, and there. I'd also like to put in a plug for anyone that's listening. CASA is always looking for people to volunteer. It is very meaningful work, and it's very necessary work. So
fine. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you, Madam.
And with that public service announcement, are there other questions of the committee? Representative Mosher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm familiar with the CASA program. It's a very good program. I just want a little clarification. As it stands right now, a child is only, I guess, eligible, for lack of a better term, to receive a CASA advocate if they've been removed from the home. Is that accurate?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Roberts.
Representative, no, not necessarily. That is how it happens in the majority of the time, but there is opportunities if there is some involvement by the system, whether that be law enforcement, DSS, it does happen, even if they have not been removed from the home.
Other questions of the committee? Follow up, Representative Mosher.
Thank you very much. One point of concern that I have is actually in regards to the CASA volunteer. If the child has not been removed from the home, when the CASA volunteer sets up appointments with this child who is going to be in the home for a majority of these instances that we're kind of considering adding right now, how does the appointment setup work? I realize it's probably not in the home, but is it a situation where the abusive parent are taking the child to the meeting? Or if you could just comment on that for clarification.
Okay. Ms. Roberts. Madam Chair, Representative, I want to clarify something. In the majority, vast majority, yes, something has happened, and we're talking about a removal from the home at the 48-hour hearing where everybody's brought before the court because there needs to be a 48-hour hearing. That is where this advocate would be. You asked me if there is ever an instance, and I can't come up with a hypothetical instance of a scenario that you're talking about, whether or not there's an abuser in there or whatever. You just asked if it's possible that it ever happens, and yes, I know that, but that would be a very rare, and I cannot come up with some sort of hypothetical in which, but this is not prohibiting a special advocate from being appointed, even though the child has not been taken out of the home, is my point.
Other questions of the committee? If not, we'll close to committee questions and open to committee discussion or action on House Bill 1084.
Madam Chairperson.
Representative Turpeville.
Thank you. I would move due pass on House Bill 1084.
Moved by Turpeville, seconded by Gibson. Remarks, Representative Turpeville.
No, I think this is this example of an excellent bill that needs no further explanation. I would urge the committee to join me in voting yes.
Anything else of the committee? If not, we have before us the do pass motion for House Bill 1084. The secretary will please call the roll. Those in favor say aye. Those opposed, no.
Representative Engel?
Aye.
Feinstein?
Aye.
Gibson?
Aye.
Gosch?
Aye.
Hamel?
Aye.
Hoffman? Killer?
Aye.
Lust?
Aye.
Moser?
Aye.
Schleckaway?
Aye.
Turpeville?
Aye.
Hunt?
Aye.
Cutler?
Aye.
Madam Chair, 12 ayes, 1 excused.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. And House Bill 1084 goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Turpeville, will you please be responsible for this bill to the caucus and on the floor? And Representative Ingalls, would you please inform your caucus? Thank you. With that, we move in the calendar to House Bill 1085. House Bill 1085, an act to revise certain provisions concerning magistrate judge jurisdiction. With that, we are open to proponent testimony on House Bill 1085.
Good morning again, Madam Chair, Committee. My name is Judith Roberts. I'm legal and legislative counsel for the UJS. I'm here to testify on behalf of the Chief Justice on House Bill 1085. 1085 was introduced to extend, in one instance, the jurisdiction of a magistrate court judge. Right now, magistrate court judges are allowed to handle misdemeanors and crime and fines of $2,000 in the criminal realm, and they are also allowed to handle civil cases up to $12,000 in damage or value or whatnot. This bill, if you look at starting at lines page 115 and page 2, 1 and 2, 32 on page 2, line 2, 32-22-55 references the operation of an oversized or overweight vehicle. That if you drive a truck, a semi, whatnot, and it's loaded too heavy. I'm not a trucker. I'm not sure exactly, you know, how all that works, but apparently you can load it too heavy, and that's a Class 2 misdemeanor. The problem is then that there's civil penalties that are in addition to the criminal Class 2 misdemeanor, and they have a whole schedule of penalties for being overweight. If you look at 32-22-55, it has a whole schedule, and the amount increases the heavier you've overloaded your vehicle or your semi-truck, the heavier the fine. Well, in certain circumstances, I suppose the most grievous of violations of this, the fines can exceed the $12,000 civil penalty jurisdiction that is provided for magistrate court judges. Therefore, for this Class 2 misdemeanor, it then has to be turned over to circuit court, which then has an effect on our scheduling and our docketing and the burden that the circuit courts are already under trying to get their cases handled when we're just dealing with a Class 2 misdemeanor. Therefore, the judges have asked that we allow this. It is very restricted. It only pertains to overweight vehicles in these cases and to nothing else for civil penalties or for civil cases. So with that, I'd ask you to support House Bill 1085, and I'll stand by for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there further proponent testimony for House Bill 1085? If not, is there any opponent testimony to House Bill 1085? Seeing none, we'll close to proponent and opponent testimony and open to questions of the committee. Are there any questions of the committee? Representative Lust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Ms. Roberts. Ms. Roberts, by expanding the magistrate court's jurisdiction in this area, are you also then limiting the violator's jury trial rights in any way?
Ms. Roberts.
Madam Chair, Representative. I do not believe so. When we were researching and debating this, there didn't seem to be any indication that any rights would be limited on in that area.
I can follow up,
Representative Lust.
Thank you. If you could, I would appreciate clarification on that.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Further questions of the committee, Representative Ingalls. If there, we'll take questions and then move back to that. If that's in order, if there are any further questions of the committee, seeing none, then we'll close to committee questions and open to committee discussion or action on House Bill 1085. Representative Ingalls.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Magistrate courts, Representative Lust, routinely conduct jury trials, and this would not be limiting anybody's right to have a jury trial. And in fact, it wouldn't be limiting their right to have an appeal either, because when a magistrate court conducts any kind of procedure, criminal in nature, the appeal first would go to the circuit court, and then from there it could go to the Supreme Court. So there's actually one additional layer of appeal that would be available to people. But a jury trial is still available, and this wouldn't affect that a bit.
Other questions or comments of the committee? If not, we are open to committee action on House Bill 1085.
Madam Chairperson.
Representative Turpeville.
I would move due pass on House Bill 1085.
Second.
Thank you, sir. Moved by Turpeville, seconded by Gosch. Remarks, Representative Turpeville.
No, I have none. Thank you.
Anything further of the committee? If not, we'll proceed to the due pass motion on House Bill 1085. The Secretary will please call the roll. Those in favor say aye. Those opposed, no.
Representative Engel.
Aye.
Feinstein.
Aye.
Gibson.
Aye.
Gosch.
Aye.
Hamel.
Aye.
Hoffman. Killer.
Aye.
Lust.
Aye.
Moser.
Aye.
Schleckaway.
Aye.
Turpeville.
Aye.
Hunt.
Aye.
Cutler.
Aye.
Madam Chair, 12 ayes, 1 excused.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. With that, House Bill 1085 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Lust, will you please carry that on the floor and to the caucus? And Representative Feinstein, would you please take that to your caucus for explanation?
Madam Chairperson.
Representative Turpeville.
If it would be appropriate, I would move consent calendar, please.
No. Thank you. I'm going to be the no voter.
I deem that not appropriate.
Thank you, though. Thank you. We will ask you to move bills that have little or no explanation needed or controversy to the consent calendar as we move forward. But for now, some of these bills coming from the Chief Justice and some from the Attorney General's office probably need a little explanation on the floor. And since we don't have a very heavy floor calendar yet established, we'll go ahead and let those bills be heard on the floor. Thank you, Representative Turbeville. And we'll be looking to you to help us with the consent calendar as we move along. Again, we have deferred House Bill 1086 to Friday, so we move then in the calendar to House Bill 1087. House Bill 1087, an act to revise certain provisions concerning the number of peremptory challenges in cases involving very high felonies. And with that, we are open to proponent testimony on House Bill 1087.
Good morning, Madam Chairman. Madam Chair. My name is Judith Roberts. I'm a legislative and legal counsel for UJS. I'm here to testify on behalf of the Chief Justice on 1087. This is a simple housekeeping bill where when there's been previous changes to this section of the code, it was overlooked to include Class C felony. Class C felony is a heavier penalty than a Class 1, and it fits in with Class A, B, and C. Class 1 would fit in below that, and so it's important that it just gets amended, and I'll stand by for some questions.
Thank you. Other proponent testimony for House Bill 1087? If not, we'll close to proponent testimony and open to opponent testimony. Is there any opponent testimony to House Bill 1087? Seeing none, we'll close to proponent and opponent testimony and open to questions of the committee. Are there any questions of the committee? Seeing none, we'll close to committee questions and open to action on House Bill 1087.
Madam Chairperson?
Representative Turbeville.
I would move to pass on 1087.
Moved by Turbeville, seconded by Gibson. Remarks, Representative Turbeville?
No, thank you.
Is there any further discussion of House Bill 1087? Seeing none, we will proceed to the do pass motion on House Bill 1087. The Secretary will please call the roll. Those in favor say aye. Those opposed, no.
Representative Engel?
Aye.
Feinstein?
Aye.
Gibson?
Aye.
Gosch?
Aye.
Hamel?
Aye.
Hoffman? Killer?
Aye.
Lust?
Aye.
Moser?
Aye.
Schleckaway?
Aye.
Turbeville?
Aye.
Hunt?
Aye.
Cutler?
Aye.
Madam Chair, 12 ayes, 1 excused.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. And House Bill 1087 goes to the floor. Do pass. Representative Gosch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to make another attempt at placing a bill on the consent calendar, if I may. I would move that we place House Bill 1087 on the consent calendar.
Second.
Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Are there any opposed? We'll let that one go. Sorry, Representative Durbeville. Thought that other bill may need, since there were some questions about it, may need a little discussion. This one really needs no explanation or discussion, so I apologize to you, Representative Durbeville. Well, we'll try to change that opinion as the weeks go by. Next in our calendar, we move to House Bill 1088. House Bill 1088, an act to provide for the continuance of certain ex parte temporary protection orders. We are open to proponent testimony on House Bill 1088.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judith Roberts, once again, on behalf of the Chief Justice and the EJS. This bill, House Bill 1088, aids both attorneys who have conflicts as well as judges in rural areas, especially where there are only certain days set aside perhaps for protection orders, or where judges only get to visit on certain days. There's some rural areas where judges ride the circuit and they only are there certain days, and if an attorney has a conflict, that can be a problem. In this bill, the judges were looking to be able to grant a continuance. There was no provision before in reference to protection orders for domestic abuse, which is Section 1, and in page 2, Section 2, that refers to protection orders in stalking cases. We've written in three protections that we think would allow for continuance, but also address any concerns that granting a continuance may bring to people. If you look on line 6, page 1, it says for good cause, a legal term. It's a standard of proof that, or a standard that needs to be presented and found by the court. There has to be good cause. Number 2 on line 7, No continuance may exceed 60 days. This is not something that anyone wants to put off or delay. So we've written in a number there to ensure that next time that judge comes through and the lawyers can get together with their calendars, there's going to be a hearing. And then on line 8, if they do grant a continuance, the ex parte temporary protection order stays in place until that rescheduled hearing, so that that person is protected, the temporary order protection order continues, and then everybody can hopefully schedule the court date within 60 days at the earliest possible date. So with that, Madam Chair and Committee, I'd ask you to support House Bill 1088, and I'll stand by for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any other proponent testimony for House Bill 1088? If not, is there any opponent testimony to House Bill 1088? Seeing none, we'll close to proponent and opponent testimony and open to questions of the committee. Representative Gosch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Ms. Roberts.
Go ahead.
I have a little bit of concern with the 60 days, because when you have the protection order put in place, the limitations that are part of the protection order can be somewhat cumbersome on the person, and if it's a situation where the protection order shouldn't stay in place, they probably want to get it removed as quickly as possible. In the situations you spoke of where judges are only available on certain times, if you changed it to 30 days, would that be enough time to have a judge be available instead of the 60 days?
Ms. Roberts.
Madam Chair. Representative, there was some discussion about the date. 30 days would, in most areas, a judge will get back at least every other week. In some rural areas, unfortunately, it does take that long. So we addressed this with some of the networks, the South Dakota Network and whatnot, and they actually sent an email that said they were in favor of this, and they liked the concept. There didn't seem to be heartburn over the 60 days, but 30 days would probably not cause too much heartburn either for the judges. As long as they can get the docketing is and the scheduling is can be difficult if with limited attorneys in the area and everyone's schedules. But
other questions of the committee? Representative Lust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a quick question on the good cause hearing. Does that include a hearing? It says unless for good cause the court grants a continuance. I presume that there would be a hearing on the continuance.
It can be by petition, or and there can be a hearing. And if you look, let me see. I'm just trying to find the statute here. It is my understanding that upon a motion, because it's an ex parte protection order or petition, temporary protection order, and they're waiting for the hearing, that if one side or the other, either side, it's not just one side that can ask for the continuance, they petition the court and it can and ask for continuance, and there's not necessarily a hearing on that, because that's the whole problem. It's a temporary ex parte protection order that has been granted, and they're scheduling the mandatory hearing that has to come next by statute, and then there's a conflict.
Other questions of the committee? If not, we will close to committee questions and open to committee discussion or action on House Bill 1088. Representative Ingalls.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I deal with protection orders in my practice on a regular basis, and one of the instances I could think of where a continuance might be requested is if they haven't been able to serve the defendant, and that happens more frequently than you might think. And in that situation, the defendant hasn't been served. The defendant wouldn't have a hearing before a continuance is granted. I'm sure somebody would go to the court and say, we haven't got him served yet. Give us a little extra time, and that's what would happen, and there wouldn't be a hearing in that instance. And there's probably some other instances where there wouldn't be a hearing on the issue of whether a continuance should be granted. But Representative Gosch brought up a good point that these hearings are supposed to be held within 30 days right now, and now we'd be adding an additional 60 days, which may or may not include a hearing, which would take it out to 90 days before a hearing had to be held. And I'm sure that the various domestic violence groups would be in favor of this because victims would have a longer protection order without a hearing. But if you're on the other end of one of these things and you have to wait 90 days to have these onerous conditions removed from you, I think that would be quite burdensome. And there are a lot of protection orders that aren't granted. So having to wait and have all these conditions placed on you for 90 days when you may not be guilty of anything, I think is a little bit troubling. So if, I would support knocking that down from 60 days to 30.
Thank you. Other comments or discussion or action on House Bill 1088? Representative Lust.
Well, just in response to the last comment by Representative Ingalls, this court has the discretion to go up to 60 days, so it's not as though it's automatically a 60-day extension. So I think the courts will have discretion and will be sensitive to the severe terms of the extent of the protection order if they see fit.
Anything else of the committee? House Bill 1088.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hunt.
I'd move to amend.
State your motion.
To where there's reference, for example, on line 7. I'm sorry, yeah, line 760, insert 30.
Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Gosch. Remarks, Representative Hunt.
Well, I think we've had good dialogue on this, and I appreciate Representative Lust's comments that, the judge can make the decision, but it's been my experience that if the statute says 60 days, the attorney's going to put in his petition motion 60 days, and so we're going to be faced with that anyway. So I support the idea of reducing it from 60 to 30 on that basis.
Representative Gosch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would suggest that we maybe amend the amendment to also include line 11 on page 2 and change the 60.
Is that a motion?
Yes, ma'am.
Is there a second? Moved by Gosch, seconded by Feinstein. Remarks, Representative Gosch.
Just that it would take care of both sections, that it would be a maximum of 30 days.
We are voting on the Gosch motion to amend the amendment, which we can do. Is there any discussion? Representative Lust.
I appreciate what Representative Hunt's objectives. My concern, and I would think it was voiced by Justice Roberts, is that having the flexibility to go to 60 days allows those judges who serve rural areas to have a little bit more flexibility with their calendar. She mentioned that may have been the impetus for this change in the first place. I do not know, and I would solicit from the members of the committee who maybe practice in rural areas, if they do, whether or not 30 days would be too restrictive when the judge is riding the circuit. I do not know that.
Further discussion of the committee? We are at the Gosch motion to amend the amendment. This is a voice vote. Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
That motion carries. So we have amended the amendment. We are back to the Hunt motion to amend, which now includes the Gosch amended version. Is there further discussion by the committee? It's a voice vote. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Are there any opposed? That motion carries. We're back to House Bill 1088 as amended.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hunt.
Move do pass on 1088.
Second.
As amended.
Move do pass as amended by Hunt, seconded by Gibson. Remarks, Representative Hunt.
Madam Chair, I think we've probably discussed this. It was a good presentation, and encourage support on the due pass motion on 1088 as amended.
Is there anything further of the committee? We'll proceed to the vote on House Bill 1088, due pass as amended. The secretary will please call the roll. Those in favor say aye. Those opposed, no.
Representative Ingalls?
Aye.
Feinstein?
Aye.
Gibson?
Aye.
Gosch?
Aye.
Hamel?
Aye.
Hoffman? Killer?
Aye.
Lust?
Aye.
Moser?
Aye.
Schleckaway?
Aye.
Turbeville? Hunt?
Aye.
Cutler?
Aye.
Madam Chair, 12 ayes, 1 excused.
And House Bill 1088 goes to the floor, due pass as amended. Representative Hunt, would you please carry that bill for us on the floor?
Yes, ma'am.
To the caucus. And Representative Ingalls, would you please explain that one to your caucus as well? Thank you. Again, we have deferred House Bill 1089 to Friday, and with that committee, we have concluded our business for the day. Is there anything further of the committee? If not, the chair entertains a motion to adjourn. Moved by Turbeville, seconded by Schleckaway. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Are there any opposed? Thank you. We are adjourned.